In the last 15 years in Canada, over 100 men and women have been murdered because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Hundreds more have suffered permanent injury and disability in homophobic attacks. Violence motivated by hatred and fear of queer people happens every day. Douglas Victor Yanoff is a policy manager at Health Canada. He is also the author of the recently published book, Pink Blood, Homophobic Violence in Canada. And he joins us on the line from Ottawa this morning to tell us about the book. Hello, Doug.
Hello.
Now, why did you decide to write a book about homophobic violence?
Well, I guess I was motivated for both personal and professional reasons. I was working as a freelance journalist in Vancouver during the 90s, and a friend of mine was gay-bashed in Stanley Park back in 1992, and so I did a little bit of investigating on it, and I actually wrote an article for the Vancouver Sun on it, and I realized that there was almost nothing that had been done on the topic at all. So I just started digging, and before I knew it, I had hundreds of cases and decided that it wouldn't all fit into an article, so I wrote a book about it.
So this is really the first kind of comprehensive study of this kind that's been done.
That's right. In Canada, there have been books that have come out and have looked at various aspects of homophobic violence in other countries, but I haven't seen one before that really looked at an entire country sort of as a case study, looking at all the various aspects of homophobic violence and how it impacts on not just the victim but on society in general.
Now, you had to rely on media reports and court judgment for much of your data. What kind of challenges did that create when you tried to measure the prevalence of homophobic violence?
Well, it was pretty difficult because really I realized that I couldn't make head or tail of the official, what little official statistics were out there just made no sense whatsoever. I mean, I talked to 25 different police departments, and they had 25 different ways of either keeping track or not keeping track of homophobic violence. So then in those few police departments where they did, I noticed that they all had their own record-keeping system. So it became very confusing, and it made me question how relevant the statistics actually were. And it's, for me, it spoke to this need that we have in Canada to have sort of a universal hate crime definition so that the stats make sense across the country.
So the problem you were having understanding it is understanding which crimes were homophobic? Was that the issue?
Well, yeah. I mean, some police departments just they don't keep track of any crimes at all related to the sexual orientation or gender identity of the victim. So, I mean, if you call the police department in some cities, they wouldn't and said how many lesbians were killed last year or how many were assaulted, they would say, well, we don't have a record keeping system that keeps track of that. Then other police departments will keep track of the sexual orientation of the victim, but we don't really know what. I mean, they give you the statistics, but you don't know whether they were gay-bashed, whether it was a domestic assault, whether they had graffiti sprayed on their car. You know, so in some ways, these statistics sometimes raise more questions than they do answers.
I guess the stereotype probably is that homophobic violence happens between strangers in public places. Was that borne out by your research?
Well, I found that yes and no. It's such a complex subject that it's hard to really give yes and no answers. But basically, in assaults involving gay men, they tended to be more random assaults on the street involving strangers. But assaults involving lesbians as victims, for example, there tended to be more of an intimate connection between the assailant and the victim. So it could have been an acquaintance, for example. Whereas the homicides were not so much strangers. So in other words, the Aaron Webster case from a few years ago in Vancouver was more unique in terms of the homicides that I studied because it was a set of strangers that were targeting.
This was a guy who was killed in Stanley Park.
Yes, in 2001. And in that case, it was strangers that were targeting the victim, whereas I found that in about two-thirds of the cases that I looked at, the victim was actually targeted in his home. So that has a different sort of twist on the scenario then.
If it is such a mixed picture, and that sometimes these are people who know each other, and sometimes they're strangers, sometimes they're acquaintances, why is it important to identify this type of crime by the sexuality of the victim?
Well, it's important because what I argue in the book is that we need to, I mean, that's just the first step. I mean, yes, we need to look at the sexual orientation of the victim, but only as a kind of stepping stone to help us understand the motivation of the assailant or the killer. And so I think that we put far too much emphasis on the victim himself or herself. And we forget about why the person is doing it. So I always go back to, okay, why is this taking place? And very often, you know, these cases of a man, you know, being killed in his home by another man, the police will dismiss it as a sort of a domestic case or as some sort of lover's quarrel or something like that, when really this involves sort of a class of criminals who go into gay bars or they go into gay areas and they pick out vulnerable gay men and they put themselves in a position of trust so that they can actually target and kill that person. So to me, there's underlying homophobia right there that needs to be addressed.
Now, the legal system offers people accused of this kind of crime defense options that other accused don't have, and one example is the unwanted sexual advance defense. Can you talk about that?
Well, some have called it the homosexual panic defense, but basically what it boils down to is in many of the cases, actually over a quarter of the cases that I analyzed of homicides involving gay men, trans people and lesbians, was that there was an allegation of that somehow the victim's homosexuality provoked the killer. So in a sense, it's not just the killer that's on trial, but it's also the victim's sexual orientation or gender identity that can be also on trial. And so it moves into sort of this pathologization process of the victim's sexuality as being so shocking or so horrifying to the killer that the killer then, you know, almost had no choice but to lash out in anger, disgust, self-defense. So you see this pattern over and over again when gay victims are targeted in homicides.
Now, you also found evidence that homophobic violence is more vicious than other violence. Why is that?
Well, the theory is that the homophobia that fuels a lot of these killings and assaults really is sort of what's really behind it. I saw a lot of extreme cases of killings, including, you know, victims being stabbed 146 times, being stabbed 60 times, 40 times, multiple killings, the body being burned after it was killed. So there were, it really was remarkable. It wasn't just, it was an argument that then got out of control and led to a lethal injury. Usually there was a lot more that went into it.
Do you think it's because of the way that queer people are portrayed in society as a whole, that's something that is possible for someone to do?
Well, there are theories of homophobia out there that say that, you know, the more negative images there are in the media, and the more negative messages that the politicians send to the general public about homosexuality, then this, in a sense, creates the groundwork. It creates a fertile base from which homophobes can operate. In other words, it provides them the ideology of heterosexism can then provide a base for this ideology of homophobia that would then allow a few extreme individuals to go further and justify their actions through violence.
Now, you say that the police collect their statistics differently in different places. Do they also respond differently when there's been a case of something that is undeniably a homophobic attack? Is the response of the police quite different in different areas?
Oh, yes. I mean, it varies dramatically from one... But then the problem with the use of your word undeniably is difficult, because one jurisdiction might deny it, while another jurisdiction would say that it's true. So, again, it goes back to this universal definition. I mean, I interviewed a hate crimes officer in Toronto who said that... that basically we were talking about a trans prostitute who'd been shot in the head, and he said that wasn't a hate crime because that didn't conform to his police department's definition of a hate crime. So my argument is, well, you know, just because some official in a service that we provide and pay taxes to does not officially acknowledge the hate that went into that particular crime, doesn't mean that it's not a hate crime. You know what I mean? It's like getting into community perceptions and trying to sort of encourage the community to articulate their own definition of hate crime rather than having officials do it for us.
Now, you argue that our society has become inured, in a sense, to violence. How can we undo that lack of concern, do you think?
I think we need to get involved on a more systematic, methodical level. I know that after Aaron Webster died, there were marches down Davie Street, and there were demonstrations, and there was outrage, and there were letters to the editor. But, you know, I've talked to queer activists in the city since then, and, you know, they're very discouraged because they feel that, you know, that initial burst of enthusiasm is gone now. And so it's left to the same, you know, half dozen dedicated activists to try and, you know, organize the committees and go to the meetings and motivate people and lobby politicians and so forth. So I think that we need to acknowledge that making these sort of legislative and policy changes in our society is hard work, and it's not glamorous. You know, it involves hours and hours of sitting in committee meetings and arguing with people and doing outreach in the community and so forth. So I guess, you know, I would say that we need to sort of look at community activism in a whole different light if we want to make the changes that are necessary.
We talk a lot about concerns of for queer people who are young, who are in high school, and who face bullying. Were they identified as a group in your book?
I did look at targeting of youth.
What did you find?
Well, I found that there is there is targeting that takes place in high schools. I find that the research that's been done so far has been sort of more talking about harassment and bullying, and there haven't been a lot of clear definitions on what that means. And because I was focusing on actual physical violence, I wasn't able to include a lot of those incidents just because I wasn't clear through their methodologies of how much of it was verbal harassment, how much of it was discrimination, and how much of it was actual physical assault. Not to say that anything is more worthy of research than the other, but I was just focusing my study on the actual physical violence. But I did find that young victims are the very, very vulnerable when it comes to this sort of victimization. I mean, they're just, especially if they're in their early stages of sexual, you know, questioning and, developing a homosexual identity, it can be very damaging to them.
I guess time and again what comes up when we're talking is the challenges of being the first study of its nature in a country when you're dealing with trying to make your definitions and trying to find the people and trying to figure it all out. It must have been a tremendous amount of work.
It was a lot of work, and sometimes I just sort of felt like I was kind of all alone in my room working on this, and I didn't have a lot of opportunity to bounce this back on other people because it was quite a new approach, you know. So I just found that I had to stumble through quite a few things, and I'm just hoping that the result that I came up with is, serves its purpose in terms of getting people to think about the issue. And I know that it's not perfect and it's not comprehensive, but I see it as a good first step to get us all debating these issues.
Now, in the conclusion of your book, you say that there's a need for a national watchdog group on homophobic violence. How would you envision this group? What would it look like?
I would see it as an organization that would be national in its scope, that would have links to grassroots organizations, and that would, you know, really be much more of a sort of an oversight group, and that would also give support to people in remote areas that are that don't necessarily have the benefit of a larger queer community in a larger city.
Thanks very much for talking to me this morning, Doug.
You're very welcome. Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with Doug Victor Yanoff. He's the author of Pink Blood, Homophobic Violence in Canada. The book is published by the University of Toronto Press.